Random House Audio presents Switch by Chip Heath and Dan Heath. Read for you by Charles Collenberg. Chapter 1. Three Surprises About Change. 1. On Saturday in 2000, some unsuspecting moviegoers showed up at a suburban theater in Chicago to catch a 1:05 p.m. matinee of Mel Gibson's action flick, Payback. They were handed a soft drink and a free bucket of popcorn and were asked to stick around after the movie to answer a few questions about the concession stand. These movie fans were unwitting participants in a study of irrational eating behavior. There was something unusual about the popcorn they received. It was wretched. In fact, it had been carefully engineered to be wretched. It had been popped 5 days earlier and was so stale that it squeaked when you ate it. One moviegoer later compared it to styrofoam packing peanuts, and two others, forgetting that they'd received the popcorn for free, demanded their money back. Some of them got their free popcorn in a medium-sized bucket. And others got a large bucket, the sort of huge tub that looks like it might once have been an above-ground swimming pool. Every person got a bucket so there'd be no need to share. The researchers responsible for the study were interested in a simple question. Would the people with the bigger buckets eat more? Both buckets were so big that none of the moviegoers could finish their individual portions, so the actual research question was a bit more specific. Would somebody with a large inexhaustible supply of popcorn eat more than someone with a smaller inexhaustible supply? The sneaky researchers weighed the buckets before and after the movie, so they were able to measure precisely how much popcorn each person ate. The results were stunning. People with the large buckets ate 53% more popcorn than people with the medium size. That's the equivalent of 173 more calories and approximately 21 extra hand dips into the bucket. Brian Wansink, the author of the study, runs the Food and Brand Lab at Cornell University, and he described the results in his book, Mindless Eating. We've run other popcorn studies, and the results were always the same. However, we tweaked the details. It didn't matter if our moviegoers were in Pennsylvania, Illinois, or Iowa, and it didn't matter what kind of movie was showing. All of our popcorn studies led to the same conclusion. People eat more when you give them a bigger container. Period. No other theory explains the behavior. These people weren't eating for pleasure. The popcorn was so stale it squeaked. They weren't driven by a desire to finish their portion. Both buckets were too big to finish. It didn't matter whether they were hungry or full. The equation is unyielding. Bigger container equals more eating. Best of all, people refused to believe the results. After the movie, the researchers told the moviegoers about the two bucket sizes and the findings of their past research. The researchers asked, "Do you think you ate more because of the larger size?" The majority scoffed at the idea, saying, "Things like that don't trick me," or, "I'm pretty good at knowing when I'm full." Whoops. 2. Imagine that someone showed you the data from the popcorn eating study but didn't mention the bucket sizes. On your data summary, you could quickly scan the results and see how much popcorn different people ate. Some people ate a little, some ate a lot, and some seemed to be testing the physical limits of the human stomach. Armed with a data set like that, you would find it easy to jump to conclusions. Some people are reasonable snackers, and others are big gluttons. A public health expert studying the data alongside you would likely get very worried about the gluttons. "We need to motivate these people to adopt healthier snacking behaviors. Let's find ways to show them the health hazards of eating so much." But wait a second. If you want people to eat less popcorn, the solution is pretty simple. Give them smaller buckets. You don't have to worry about their knowledge or their attitudes. You can see how easy it would be to turn any easy change problem, shrinking people's buckets, into a hard change problem, convincing people to think differently. And that's the first surprise about change. What looks like a people problem is often a situation problem. 3. This is a book to help you change things. We consider change at every level, individual, organizational, and societal. Maybe you want to help your brother beat his gambling addiction. Maybe you need your team at work to act more frugally because of market conditions. Maybe you wish more of your neighbors would bike to work. Usually these topics are treated separately. There is change management advice for executives and self-help advice for individuals and change the world advice for activists. That's a shame, because all change efforts have something in common. For anything to change, Someone has to start acting differently. Your brother has got to stay out of the casino. Your employees have got to start booking coach fares. Ultimately, all change efforts boil down to the same mission. Can you get people to start behaving in a new way? We know what you're thinking. People resist change, but it's not quite that easy. Babies are born every day to parents who inexplicably welcome the change. Think about the sheer magnitude of that. Would anyone agree to work for a boss who'd wake you up twice a night screaming for trivial administrative duties? And what if, every time you wore a new piece of clothing, the boss spit up on it? Yet people don't resist this massive change. They volunteer for it. In our lives, we embrace lots of big changes. Not only babies, but marriages and new homes and new technologies and new job duties. Meanwhile, other behaviors are maddeningly intractable. Smokers keep smoking, and kids grow fatter, and your husband can't ever seem to get his dirty shirts into a hamper. So there are hard changes and easy changes. What distinguishes one from the other? In this book, we argue that successful changes share a common pattern. They require the leader of the change to do three things at once. We've already mentioned one of those three things. To change someone's behavior, you've got to change that person's situation. The situation isn't the whole game, of course. You can send an alcoholic to rehab where the new environment will help him go dry. But what happens when he leaves and loses that influence? You might see a boost in productivity from your sales reps when the sales manager shadows them, but what happens afterward when the situation returns to normal? For individuals' behavior to change, you've got to influence not only their environment, but their hearts and minds. The problem is this. Often the heart and mind disagree fervently. 4. Consider the clocky, an alarm clock invented by an MIT student, Gauri Nanda. It's no ordinary alarm clock. It has wheels. You set it at night, and in the morning when the alarm goes off, it rolls off your nightstand and scurries around the room, forcing you to chase it down. Picture the scene. You're crawling around the bedroom in your underwear, stalking and cursing a runaway clock. Clocky ensures that you won't snooze button your way to disaster, and apparently that's a common fear, since about 35,000 units were purchased at $50 each in Clocky's first 2 years on the market, despite minimal marketing. The success of this invention reveals a lot about human psychology. What it shows, fundamentally, is that we are schizophrenic. Part of us, our rational side, wants to get up at 5:45 a.m., allowing ourselves plenty of time for a quick jog before we leave for the office. The other part of us, the emotional side, wakes up in the darkness of the early morning, snoozing inside a warm cocoon of sheets and blankets, and wants nothing in the world so much as a few more minutes of sleep. If, like us, your emotional side tends to win these internal debates, then you might be a potential clocky customer. The beauty of this device is that it allows your rational side to outsmart your emotional side. It's simply impossible to stay cuddled up under the covers when a rogue alarm clock is rolling around your room. Let's be blunt here. Clocky is not a product for a sane species. If Spock wants to get up at 5:45 a.m., he'll just get up. No drama required. Our built-in schizophrenia is a deeply weird thing, but we don't think much about it because we're so used to it. When we kick off a new diet, we toss the Cheetos and Oreos out of the pantry, because our rational side knows that when our emotional side gets a craving, there's no hope of self-control. The only option is to remove the temptation altogether. For the record, some MIT student will make a fortune designing Cheetos that scurry away from people when they're on a diet. The unavoidable conclusion is this: your brain isn't of one mind. The conventional wisdom in psychology, in fact, is that the brain has two independent systems at work at all times. First, there's what we called the emotional side. It's the part of you that is instinctive, that feels pain and pleasure. Second, there's the rational side, also known as the reflective or conscious system. It's the part of you that deliberates and analyzes and looks into the future. In the past few decades, psychologists have learned a lot about these two systems, but of course, mankind has always been aware of the tension. Plato said that in our heads, we have a rational charioteer who has to rein in an unruly horse that barely yields to horsewhip and goad combined. Freud wrote about the selfish id and the conscientious superego, and also about the ego which mediates between them. More recently, behavioral economists dubbed the two systems the planner and the doer. But to us, the duo's tension is captured best by an analogy used by University of Virginia psychologist Jonathan Haidt in his wonderful book, The Happiness Hypothesis. Haidt says that our emotional side is an elephant and our rational side is its rider. Perched atop the elephant, the rider holds the reins and seems to be the leader, but the rider's control is precarious because the rider is so small relative to the elephant. Anytime the 6-ton elephant and the rider disagree about which direction to go, the rider is going to lose. He's completely overmatched. Most of us are all too familiar with situations in which our elephant overpowers our rider. You've experienced this if you've ever slept in, overeaten, dialed up your ex at midnight, procrastinated, tried to quit smoking and failed, skipped the gym, gotten angry and said something you regretted, abandoned your Spanish or piano lessons, refused to speak up in a meeting because you were scared, and so on. Good thing no one is keeping score. The weakness of the elephant, our emotional and instinctive side, is clear. It's lazy and skittish, often looking for the quick payoff, ice cream cone, over the long-term payoff, being thin. When change efforts fail, it's usually the elephant's fault, since the kinds of change we want typically involve short-term sacrifices for long-term payoffs. We cut back on expenses today to yield a better balance sheet next year. We avoid ice cream today for a better body next year. Changes often fail because the rider simply can't keep the elephant on the road long enough to reach the destination. The elephant's hunger for instant gratification is the opposite of the rider's strength, which is the ability to think long-term, to plan, to think beyond the moment, all those things that your pet can't do. But what may surprise you is that the elephant also has enormous strengths, and that the rider has crippling weaknesses. The elephant isn't always the bad guy. Emotion is the elephant's turf. Love and compassion and sympathy and loyalty, that fierce instinct you have to protect your kids from harm, that's the elephant. That spine-stiffening you feel when you need to stand up for yourself, that's the elephant. And even more important, if you're contemplating a change, the elephant is the one who gets things done. To make progress toward a goal, whether it's noble or crass, requires the energy and drive of the elephant. And this strength is the mirror image of the rider's great weakness, spinning its wheels. The rider tends to overanalyze and overthink things. Chances are you know people with rider problems. Your friend who can agonize for 20 minutes about what to eat for dinner. Your colleague who can brainstorm about new ideas for hours, but can't ever seem to make a decision. If you want to change things, you've got to appeal to both. The rider provides the planning and direction, and the elephant provides the energy. So if you reach the riders of your team, but not the elephants, team members will have understanding without motivation. If you reach their elephants, but not their riders, they'll have passion without direction. In both cases, the flaws can be paralyzing. A reluctant elephant and a wheel-spinning rider can both ensure that nothing changes. But when elephants and riders move together, change can come easily. 5. When rider and elephant disagree about which way to move, you've got a problem. The rider can get his way temporarily. He can tug on the reins hard enough to get the elephant to submit. Anytime you use willpower, you're doing exactly that. But the rider can't win a tug-of-war with a huge animal for long. He simply gets exhausted. To see this point more clearly, consider the behavior of some college students who participated in a study about food perception, or so they were told. They reported to the lab a bit hungry. They'd been asked not to eat for at least 3 hours beforehand. They were led to a room that smelled amazing. The researchers had just baked chocolate chip cookies. On a table in the center of the room were two bowls. One held a sampling of chocolates, along with the warm, fresh-baked chocolate chip cookies they'd smelled. The other bowl held a bunch of radishes. The researchers had prepped a cover story. "We've selected chocolates and radishes because they have highly distinctive tastes. Tomorrow we'll contact you and ask about your memory of the taste sensations you experienced while eating them." Half the participants were asked to eat 2 or 3 cookies and some chocolate candies, but no radishes. The other half were asked to eat at least 2 or 3 radishes, but no cookies. While they ate, the researchers left the room, intending, rather sadistically, to induce temptation. They wanted those poor radish eaters to sit there alone, nibbling on rabbit food, glancing enviously at the fresh-baked cookies. It probably goes without saying that the cookie eaters experienced no great struggle in resisting the radishes. Despite the temptation, all participants ate what they were asked to eat, and none of the radish eaters snuck a cookie. That's willpower at work. At that point, the taste study was officially over, and another group of researchers entered with a second, supposedly unrelated study. "We're trying to find who's better at solving problems, college students or high school students." This framing was intended to get the college students to puff out their chests and take the forthcoming task seriously. The college students were presented with a series of puzzles that required them to trace a complicated geometric shape without retracing any lines and without lifting their pencils from the paper. They were given multiple sheets of paper so they could try over and over. In reality, the puzzles were designed to be unsolvable. The researchers wanted to see how long the college students would persist in a difficult, frustrating task before they finally gave up. The untempted students, who had not had to resist eating the chocolate chip cookies, spent 19 minutes on the task, making 34 well-intentioned attempts to solve the problem. The radish eaters were less persistent. They gave up after only 8 minutes, less than half the time spent by the cookie eaters, and they managed only 19 solution attempts. Why did they quit so easily? The answer may surprise you. They ran out of self-control. In studies like this one, psychologists have discovered that self-control is an exhaustible resource. It's like doing bench presses at the gym. The first one is easy, when your muscles are fresh. But with each additional repetition, your muscles get more exhausted, until you can't lift the bar again. The radish eaters had drained their self-control by resisting the cookies. So, when their elephants, inevitably, started complaining about the puzzle task, "It's too hard, it's no fun, we're no good at this," their riders didn't have enough strength to yank on the reins for more than 8 minutes. Meanwhile, the cookie eaters had a fresh, untaxed rider who fought off the elephant for 19 minutes. Self-control is an exhaustible resource. This is a crucial realization, because when we talk about self-control, we don't mean the narrow sense of the word, as in the willpower needed to fight vice, smokes, cookies, alcohol. We're talking about a broader kind of self-supervision. Think of the way your mind works when you're giving negative feedback to an employee, or assembling a new bookshelf, or learning a new dance. You are careful and deliberate with your words or movements. It feels like there's a supervisor on duty. That's self-control, too. Contrast that with all the situations in which your behavior doesn't feel supervised. For instance, the sensation while you're driving that you can't remember the last few miles of road, or the easy, unthinking way you take a shower or make your morning coffee. Much of our daily behavior, in fact, is more automatic than supervised, and that's a good thing, because the supervised behavior is the hard stuff. It's draining. Dozens of studies have demonstrated the exhausting nature of self-supervision. For instance, people who were asked to make tricky choices and trade-offs, such as setting up a wedding registry or ordering a new computer, were worse at focusing and solving problems than others who hadn't made the tough choices. In one study, some people were asked to restrain their emotions while watching a sad movie about sick animals. Afterward, they exhibited less physical endurance than others who'd let the tears flow freely. The research shows that we burn up self-control in a wide variety of situations. Managing the impression we're making on others, coping with fears, controlling our spending, trying to focus on simple instructions such as "don't think of a white bear," and many, many others. Here's why this matters for change. When people try to change things, they're usually tinkering with behaviors that have become automatic, and changing those behaviors requires careful supervision by the rider. The bigger the change you're suggesting, the more it will sap people's self-control. And when people exhaust their self-control, what they're exhausting are the mental muscles needed to think creatively, to focus, to inhibit their impulses, and to persist in the face of frustration or failure. In other words, they're exhausting precisely the mental muscles needed to make a big change. So when you hear people say that change is hard because people are lazy or resistant, that's just flat wrong. In fact, the opposite is true. Change is hard because people wear themselves out, and that's the second surprise about change. What looks like laziness is often exhaustion. 6. John Stegner believed the company he worked for, a large manufacturer, was wasting vast sums of money. I thought we had an opportunity to drive down purchasing costs, not by 2%, but by something on the order of $1 billion over the next 5 years, said Stegner, who is quoted in John Cotter and Dan Cohen's essential book, The Heart of Change. To reap these savings, a big process shift would be required, and for that shift to occur, Stegner knew that he'd have to convince his bosses. He also knew that they'd never embrace such a big shift unless they believed in the opportunity. And for the most part, they didn't. Seeking a compelling example of the company's poor purchasing habits, Stegner assigned a summer student intern to investigate a single item, work gloves, which workers in most of the company's factories wore. The student embarked on a mission to identify all the types of gloves used in all of the company's factories and then trace back what the company was paying for them. The intrepid intern soon reported that the factories were purchasing 424 different kinds of gloves. Furthermore, they were using different glove suppliers, and they were all negotiating their own prices. The same pair of gloves that cost $5 at one factory might cost $17 at another. At Stegner's request, the student collected a specimen of every one of the 424 different types of gloves and tagged each with the price paid. Then all the gloves were gathered up, brought to the boardroom, and piled on the conference table. Stegner invited all the division presidents to come visit the glove shrine. He recalled the scene. What they saw was a large, expensive table, normally clean or with a few papers, now stacked high with gloves. Each of our executives stared at this display for a minute. Then each said something like, "We really buy all these different kinds of gloves?" "Well, as a matter of fact, yes, we do." "Really?" "Yes, really." Then they walked around the table. They could see the prices. They looked at two gloves that seemed exactly alike, yet one was marked $3.22, and the other $10.55. It's a rare event when these people don't have anything to say, but that day, they just stood with their mouths gaping. The gloves exhibit soon became a traveling roadshow, visiting dozens of plants. The reaction was visceral. "This is crazy! We're crazy! And we've got to make sure this stops happening." Soon, Stegner had exactly the mandate for change that he'd sought. The company changed its purchasing process and saved a great deal of money. This was exactly the happy ending everyone wanted, except, of course, for the glove salesman who'd managed to sell the $5 gloves for $17. 7. Let's be honest. Most of us would not have tried what Stegner did. It would have been so easy, so natural, to make a presentation that spoke only to the writer. Think of the possibilities, the spreadsheets, the savings data, the cost-cutting protocols, the recommendations for supplier consolidation, the exquisite logic for central purchasing. You could have created a 12-tabbed Microsoft Excel spreadsheet that would have made a tax accountant weep with joy. But instead of doing any of that, Stegner dumped a bunch of gloves on a table and invited his bosses to see them. If there is such a thing as white-collar courage, surely this was an instance. Stegner knew that if things were going to change, he had to get his colleagues' elephants on his side. If he had made an analytical appeal, he probably would have gotten some supportive nods, and the execs might have requested a follow-up meeting 6 weeks later, and then rescheduled it. The analytical case was compelling. By itself, it might have convinced Stegner's colleagues that overhauling the purchasing system would be an important thing to do next year. Remember that if you reach your colleagues' riders but not their elephants, they will have direction without motivation. Maybe their riders will drag the elephant down the road for a while, but as we've seen, that effort can't last long. Once you break through to feeling, though, things change. Stegner delivered a jolt to his colleagues. First, they thought to themselves, "We're crazy." Then they thought, "We can fix this." Everyone could think of a few things to try to fix the glove problem, and by extension, the ordering process as a whole. That got their elephants fired up to move. We don't expect potential billion-dollar change stories to come dressed up like this. The change effort was led by a single employee, with the able help of a summer intern. It focused on a single product. The scope of the presentation didn't correspond in any way to the scope of the proposal. Yet, Stegner's strategy worked. That's the power of speaking both to the writer and the elephant. 8. It's true that an unmotivated elephant can doom a change effort. But let's not forget that the rider has his own issues. He's a navel gazer, an analyzer, a wheel spinner. If the rider isn't sure exactly what direction to go, he tends to lead the elephant in circles. And as we'll see, that tendency explains the third and final surprise about change. What looks like resistance is often a lack of clarity. Two health researchers, Steve Booth Butterfield and Bill Rieger, professors at West Virginia University, were contemplating ways to persuade people to eat a healthier diet. From past research, they knew that people were more likely to change when the new behavior expected of them was crystal clear. But unfortunately, eating a healthier diet was anything but. Where to begin? Which foods should people stop or start eating? Should they change their eating behavior at breakfast, lunch, or dinner, at home or in restaurants? The number of ways to eat healthier is limitless, especially given the starting place of the average American diet. This is exactly the kind of situation in which the rider will spin his wheels, analyzing and agonizing and never moving forward. As the two researchers brainstormed, their thoughts kept coming back to milk. Most Americans drink milk, and we all know that milk is a great source of calcium. But milk is also the single largest source of saturated fat in the typical American's diet. In fact, calculations showed something remarkable. If Americans switched from whole milk to skim milk or 1% milk, the average diet would immediately attain the USDA recommended levels of saturated fat. How do you get Americans to start drinking low-fat milk? You make sure it shows up in their refrigerators. And that isn't an entirely facetious answer. People will drink whatever is around the house. A family will plow through low-fat milk as fast as whole milk. So, in essence, the problem was even easier than anticipated. You don't need to change drinking behavior. You need to change purchasing behavior. Suddenly, the intervention became razor sharp. What behavior do we want to change? We want consumers to buy skim or 1% milk. When? When they're shopping for groceries. Where? Duh. What else needs to change? Nothing, for now. Rieger and Booth Butterfield launched a campaign in two communities in West Virginia, running spots on the local media outlets, TV, newspaper, radio, for 2 weeks. In contrast to the bland messages of most public health campaigns, the 1% milk campaign was punchy and specific. One ad trumpeted the fact that one glass of whole milk has the same amount of saturated fat as five strips of bacon. At a press conference, the researchers showed local reporters a tube full of fat, the equivalent of an amount found in a half gallon of whole milk. Notice the elephant appeals. They're going for an, oh, gross, reaction. Rieger and Booth Butterfield monitored milk sales data at all 8 stores in the intervention area. Before the campaign, the market share of low-fat milk was 18%. After the campaign, it was 41%. 6 months later, it held at 35%. This brings us to the final part of the pattern that characterizes successful changes. If you want people to change, you must provide crystal clear direction. By now, you can understand the reason this is so important. It's so the rider doesn't spin his wheels. If you tell people to act healthier, think of how many ways they can interpret that. Imagine their riders contemplating the options endlessly. Do I need more grains or less meat? Or vice versa. Do I start taking vitamins? Would it be a good trade-off if I exercise more and bribe myself with ice cream? Should I switch to Diet Coke, or is the artificial sweetener worse than the calories? What looks like resistance is often lack of clarity. Before this study, we might have looked at these West Virginians and concluded they were the kind of people who don't care about their health. But if they were indeed that kind of people, why was it so easy to shift their behavior? If you want people to change, you don't ask them to act healthier. You say, next time you're in the dairy aisle of the grocery store, reach for a jug of 1% milk instead of whole milk. 9. Now you've had a glimpse of the basic 3-part framework we will unpack in this book, one that can guide you in any situation where you need to change behavior. Direct the rider. What looks like resistance is often a lack of clarity. So, provide crystal clear direction. Think 1% milk. Motivate the elephant. What looks like laziness is often exhaustion. The rider can't get his way by force for very long, so it's critical that you engage people's emotional side. Get their elephants on the path and cooperative. Think of the cookies and radishes study, and the boardroom conference table full of gloves. Shape the path. What looks like a people problem is often a situation problem. We call the situation, including the surrounding environment, the path. When you shape the path, you make change more likely, no matter what's happening with the rider and elephant. Think of the effect of shrinking movie popcorn buckets. We created this framework to be useful for people who don't have scads of authority or resources. Some people can get their way by fiat. CEOs, for instance, can sell off divisions, hire people, fire people, change incentive systems, merge teams, and so on. Politicians can pass laws or impose punishments to change behavior. The rest of us don't have these tools, although admittedly they would make life easier. Son, if you don't take out the trash tonight, you're fired. In this book, we don't talk a lot about these structural methods. As helpful as we hope this framework will be to you, we're well aware, and you should be too, that this framework is no panacea. For one thing, it's incomplete. We've deliberately left out lots of great thinking on change in the interests of creating a framework that's simple enough to be practical. For another, there's a good reason why change can be difficult. The world doesn't always want what you want. You want to change how others are acting, but they get a vote. You can cajole, influence, inspire, and motivate. But sometimes, an employee would rather lose his job than move out of his comfortable routines. Sometimes the alcoholic will want another drink, no matter what the consequences. So we don't promise that we're going to make change easy, but at least we can make it easier. Our goal is to teach you a framework based on decades of scientific research that is simple enough to remember and flexible enough to use in many different situations, family, work, community, and otherwise. To change behavior, you've got to direct the rider, motivate the elephant, and shape the path. If you can do all three at once, dramatic change can happen, even if you don't have lots of power or resources behind you. For proof of that, we don't need to look beyond Donald Berwick, a man who changed the face of healthcare. 10. In 2004, Donald Berwick, a doctor, and the CEO of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, IHI, had some ideas about how to save lives, massive numbers of lives. Researchers at the IHI had analyzed patient care with the kinds of analytical tools used to assess the quality of cars coming off a production line. They discovered that the defect rate in healthcare was as high as 1 in 10, meaning, for example, that 10% of patients did not receive their antibiotics in the specified time. This was a shockingly high defect rate. Many other industries had managed to achieve performance levels of one error in 1,000 cases, and often far better. Berwick knew that the high medical defect rate meant that tens of thousands of patients were dying every year unnecessarily. Berwick's insight was that hospitals could benefit from the same kind of rigorous process improvements that had worked in other industries. Couldn't a transplant operation be produced as consistently and flawlessly as a Toyota Camry? Berwick's ideas were so well supported by research that they were essentially indisputable, yet little was happening. He certainly had no ability to force any changes in the industry. IHI had only 75 employees, but Berwick wasn't deterred. On December 14, 2004, he gave a speech to a room full of hospital administrators at a large industry convention. He said, "Here is what I think we should do. I think we should save 100,000 lives. And I think we should do that by June 14, 2006, 18 months from today. Some is not a number. Soon is not a time. Here's the number, 100,000. Here's the time, June 14th, 2006, 9 a.m. The crowd was astonished. The goal was daunting. But Berwick was quite serious about his intentions. He and his tiny team set out to do the impossible. IHI proposed 6 very specific interventions to save lives. For instance, 1 asked hospitals to adopt a set of proven procedures for managing patients on ventilators to prevent them from getting pneumonia, a common cause of unnecessary death. 1 of the procedures called for a patient's head to be elevated between 30 and 45 degrees so that oral secretions couldn't get into the windpipe. Of course, all hospital administrators agreed with the goal to save lives. But the road to that goal was filled with obstacles. For one thing, for a hospital to reduce its defect rate, it had to acknowledge having a defect rate. In other words, it had to admit that some patients were dying needless deaths. Hospital lawyers had not been keen to put this admission on the record. Berwick knew he had to address the hospital's squeamishness about admitting error. At his December 14th speech, he was joined by the mother of a girl who had been killed by a medical error. She said, "I'm a little speechless, and I'm a little sad, because I know that if this campaign had been in place 4 or 5 years ago, that Josie would be fine. But I'm happy. I'm thrilled to be part of this, because I know you can do it, because you have to do it." Another guest on the stage, the chair of the North Carolina State Hospital Association, said, "An awful lot of people for a long time have had their heads in the sand on this issue, and it's time to do the right thing. It's as simple as that." IHI made joining the campaign easy. It required only a 1-page form signed by a hospital CEO. By 2 months after Berwick's speech, over 1,000 hospitals had enrolled. Once a hospital enrolled, the IHI team helped the hospital embrace the new interventions. Team members provided research, step-by-step instruction guides, and training. They arranged conference calls for hospital leaders to share their victories and struggles with one another. They encouraged hospitals with early successes to become mentors to hospitals just joining the campaign. The friction in the system was substantial. Adopting the IHI interventions required hospitals to overcome decades worth of habits and routines. Many doctors were irritated by the new procedures, which they perceived as constricting. But the adopting hospitals were seeing dramatic results, and their visible successes attracted more hospitals to join the campaign. 18 months later, at the exact moment he'd promised to return, June 14, 2006, at 9 a.m., Berwick took the stage again to announce the results. "Hospitals enrolled in the 100,000 Lives campaign have collectively prevented an estimated 122,300 avoidable deaths and, as importantly, have become to institutionalize new standards of care that will continue to save lives and improve health outcomes into the future." The crowd was euphoric. Don Berwick, with his 75-person team at IHI, had convinced thousands of hospitals to change their behavior, and collectively, they'd saved 122,300 lives, the equivalent of throwing a life preserver to every man, woman, and child in Ann Arbor, Michigan. This outcome was the fulfillment of the vision Berwick had articulated as he closed his speech 18 months earlier about how the world would look when hospitals achieved the 100,000 lives goal. "And we celebrate, starting with pizza and ending with champagne. We will celebrate the importance of what we have undertaken to do, the courage of honesty, the joy of companionship, the cleverness of a field operation, and the results we will achieve. We will celebrate ourselves, because the patients whose lives we save cannot join us, because their names can never be known. Our contribution will be what did not happen to them. And though they are unknown, we will know that mothers and fathers are at graduations and weddings that they would have missed, and that grandchildren will know their grandparents they might never have known. And holidays will be taken, and work completed, and books read, and symphonies heard, and gardens tended that, without our work, would have been only beds of weeds. 11. Big changes can happen. Don Berwick and his team catalyzed a change that saved 100,000 lives. Yet Berwick himself wielded no power. He couldn't change the law. He couldn't fire hospital leaders who didn't agree with him. He couldn't pay bonuses to hospitals that accepted his proposals. Berwick had the same tools the rest of us have. First, he directed his audience's riders. The destination was crystal clear. Some is not a number. Soon is not a time. Here's the number. 100,000. Here's the time. June 14th, 2006, 9 a.m. But that wasn't enough. He had to help hospitals figure out how to get there. And he couldn't simply say, "Try harder." Remember, act healthier versus buy 1% milk. So, he proposed 6 specific interventions, such as elevating the heads of patients on ventilators, that were known to save lives. By staying laser-focused on these 6 interventions, Berwick made sure not to exhaust the riders of his audience with endless behavioral changes. Second, he motivated his audience's elephants. He made them feel the need for change. Many of the people in the audience already knew the facts, but knowing was not enough. Remember, knowing wasn't enough for executives at John Stegner's company. It took a stack of gloves to get their elephants engaged. Berwick had to get beyond knowing. So he brought his audience face to face with the mother of the girl who'd been killed by a medical error. "I know that if this campaign had been in place 4 or 5 years ago, that Josie would be fine." Berwick was also careful to motivate the people who hadn't been in the room for his presentation. He didn't challenge people to overhaul medicine or bring TQM to healthcare. He challenged them to save 100,000 lives. That speaks to anyone's elephant. Third, he shaped the path. He made it easier for the hospitals to embrace the change. Think of the one-page enrollment form, the step-by-step instructions, the training, the support groups, the mentors. He was designing an environment that made it more likely for hospital administrators to reform. Berwick also knew that behavior was contagious. He used peer pressure to persuade hospitals to join the campaign. "Your rival hospital across town just signed on to help save 100,000 lives. Do you really want them to have the moral high ground?" He also connected people. He matched up people who were struggling to implement the changes with people who had mastered them, almost like the mentors found in Alcoholics Anonymous. Berwick was creating a support group for healthcare reform. In this book, you'll learn about people like Berwick, who've created sweeping change despite having few resources and little structural authority. You'll learn about an entrepreneur who saved his small company by turning his skeptical employees into customer service zealots. A student fresh out of college who saved an endangered species from extinction. A manager who plotted a way to get his colleague to stop acting like a jerk. And a therapist who reformed a group of child abusers. Whether the switch you seek is in your family, in your charity, in your organization, or in society at large, you'll get there by making 3 things happen. You'll direct the rider, motivate the elephant, and shape the path. Direct the rider. Chapter 2. Find the bright spots. 1. In 1990, Jerry Sternin was working for Save the Children, the international organization that helps children in need. He'd been asked to open a new office in Vietnam. The government had invited Save the Children into the country to fight malnutrition. But when Sternin arrived, the welcome was rather chilly. The foreign minister let him know that not everyone in the government appreciated his presence. The minister told Sternin, "You have 6 months to make a difference." Sternin was traveling with his wife and 10-year-old son. None of them spoke Vietnamese. "We were like orphans at the airport when we arrived in Vietnam," he recalled. "We had no idea what we were going to do. Sternin had minimal staff and meager resources. Sternin had read as much as he could about the malnutrition problem. The conventional wisdom was that malnutrition was the result of an intertwined set of problems. Sanitation was poor. Poverty was nearly universal. Clean water was not readily available. The rural people tended to be ignorant about nutrition. In Sternin's judgment, all of this analysis was TBU, true, but useless. Millions of kids can't wait for those issues to be addressed, he said. If addressing malnutrition required ending poverty and purifying water and building sanitation systems, then it would never happen, especially in 6 months, with almost no money to spend. Sternin had a better idea. He traveled to rural villages and met with groups of local mothers. The mothers divided into teams and went out to weigh and measure every child in their village. Then they pored over the results together. Sternin asked them, "Did you find any very, very poor kids who are bigger and healthier than the typical child?" The women, scanning the data, nodded and said, "Ka, ka, ka, yes, yes, yes." Sternin said, "You mean it's possible today in this village for a very poor family to have a well-nourished child? Ka, ka, ka. Then let's go see what they're doing." Sternin's strategy was to search the community for bright spots, successful efforts worth emulating. If some kids were healthy despite their disadvantages, that meant malnourishment was not inevitable. Furthermore, the mere existence of healthy kids provided hope for a practical short-term solution. Sternin knew he couldn't fix the thorny root causes, but if a handful of kids were staying healthy against the odds, why couldn't every kid be healthy? Notice that Sternin was trying to focus the mother's riders. The overall topic, what can you do to make your child healthier, is simply too big and loaded to take on at once. The mothers needed direction, not motivation. After all, every mother's elephant is going to be motivated to make her child healthier. But how? Remember the power of the 1% milk campaign, which made an abstract idea, eat healthier, practical. Sternin was saying, let's not sit around analyzing malnutrition. Let's go study what these bright spot mothers are doing. As a first step, Sternin and the mothers had to eliminate any bright spots who weren't typical. For example, a boy might have an uncle in the government who could send extra food his way. Other families wouldn't be able to replicate that. In order to recognize what the bright spot mothers were doing differently, the group had to synthesize the conventional wisdom about feeding kids. So they talked to dozens of people, mothers, fathers, older brothers and sisters, grandparents, and discovered that the community norms were pretty clear. Kids ate twice a day along with the rest of their families. They ate food that was appropriate for kids. Soft, pure foods, like the highest quality rice. Armed with an understanding of the norms, Sternin and the mothers went into the homes of the bright spot kids and observed the way the homes were run, alert for any deviations. Their observations yielded some unexpected insights. For one thing, bright spot moms were feeding their kids 4 meals a day, using the same amount of food as other moms, but spreading it across 4 servings rather than 2. The larger twice-a-day meals eaten by most families turned out to be a mistake for children, because their malnourished stomachs couldn't process that much food at one time. The style of eating was also different. Most parents believed that their kids understood their own needs and would feed themselves appropriately from the communal bowl, but the healthy kids were fed more actively, hand-fed by parents if necessary. They were even encouraged to eat when they were sick, which was not the norm. Perhaps most interesting, the healthy kids were eating different kinds of food. The bright spot mothers were collecting tiny shrimp and crabs from the rice paddies and mixing them in with their kids' rice. Shrimp and crabs were eaten by adults, but generally weren't considered appropriate food for kids. The mothers also tossed in sweet potato greens, which were considered a low-class food. These dietary improvisations, however strange or low-class, were doing something precious, adding sorely needed protein and vitamins to the children's diet. As an outsider, Sternin never could have foreseen these practices. He knew nothing about sweet potato greens. The solution was a native one, emerging from the real-world experience of the villagers, and for that reason was inherently realistic and inherently sustainable. But knowing the solution wasn't enough. For anything to change, lots of mothers needed to adopt the new cooking habits. Most people in Sternin's situation would have been itching to make an announcement, to call the village together and unveil a set of recommendations. "Gather round, everyone. I've studied your problem, and now I have the answer. Here are Sternin's 5 rules for fighting malnutrition. But Sternin refused to make a formal announcement. Knowledge does not change behavior, he said. We have all encountered crazy shrinks and obese doctors and divorced marriage counselors. He knew that telling the mothers about nutrition wouldn't change their behavior. They'd have to practice it. The community designed a program in which 50 malnourished families in groups of 10 would meet at a hut each day and prepare food. The families were required to bring shrimp, crabs, and sweet potato greens. The mothers washed their hands with soap and cooked the meal together. Sternin said that the moms were acting their way into a new way of thinking. Most important, it was their change, something that arose from the local wisdom of the village. Sternin's role was only to help them see that they could do it, that they could conquer malnutrition on their own. By organizing these cooking groups, Sternin was addressing both the rider and the elephant. The mothers' riders got highly specific instructions. Here's how to cook a tasty lunch with shrimp and sweet potato greens. And their elephants got a feeling, hope. There really is a way to make my daughter healthier, and it's not very hard. It's something I can do. Notice that the path played a role too. When so many of the mothers were doing something, there was strong social pressure to go along. The cooking classes, in effect, were changing the culture of the village. Best of all, bright spots solve the not-invented-here problem. Some people have a knee-jerk, skeptical response to imported solutions. Imagine the public outcry if an American politician proposed that the United States adopt the French healthcare system, or vice versa. We all think our group is the smartest. By looking for bright spots within the very village he was trying to change, Sternin ensured that the solution would be a native one. He would have faced a much more difficult quest if he'd brought in a plan from a different village. The local mothers would have bristled. Those people aren't like us. Our situation is more complicated than that. Those ideas wouldn't work here. Finding bright spots, then, solves many different problems at once. That's no surprise. Successful change efforts involve connecting all 3 parts of the framework: rider, elephant, and path. Although in this book we explain one part of the framework at a time, we'll continue to remind you that even an example in the rider chapters will influence the elephant and path. Concepts are rarely exclusive. 6 months after Sternin had come to the Vietnamese village, 65% of the kids were better nourished and stayed that way. Later, when researchers from Emory University's School of Public Health came to Vietnam to gather independent data, they found that even children who hadn't been born when Sternin left the villages were as healthy as the kids Sternin had reached directly. That discovery provided proof that the changes had stuck. Sternin's success began to spread. We took the first 14 villages in different phases of the program and turned them into a social laboratory. People who wanted to replicate the nutrition model came from different parts of Vietnam. Every day they would go to this living university, to these villages, touching, smelling, sniffing, watching, listening. They would graduate to go to their villages and implement the process until they got it right. The program reached 2.2 million Vietnamese people in 265 villages. Our living university has become a national model for teaching villagers to reduce drastically malnutrition in Vietnam, Sternin said. Stories don't come much more heroic than this. Sternin and his small team of believers, working with a shoestring budget, managed to make a big dent in malnutrition. What makes it more remarkable is that they weren't experts. They didn't walk in with all the answers. All they had was a deep faith in the power of bright spots. 2. The rider part of our minds has many strengths. The rider is a thinker and a planner and can plot a course for a better future. But as we've seen, the rider has a terrible weakness, the tendency to spin his wheels. The rider loves to contemplate and analyze, and making matters worse, his analysis is almost always directed at problems rather than the bright spots. You can probably recall a conversation with a friend who agonized for hours over a particular relationship problem. But can you remember an instance when a friend spent even a few minutes analyzing why something was working so well? these analytical qualities can be extremely helpful, obviously. Many problems get solved through analysis. But in situations where change is needed, too much analysis can doom the effort. The writer will see too many problems and spend too much time sizing them up. Look again at Jerry Sternin and the Vietnam story. Dozens of experts had analyzed the situation in Vietnam. Their writers had agonized over the problems. The water supply, the sanitation, the poverty, the ignorance. They'd written position papers and research documents and development plans, but they hadn't changed a thing. In tough times, the writer sees problems everywhere, and analysis paralysis often kicks in. The writer will spin his wheels indefinitely unless he's given clear direction. That's why, to make progress on a change, you need ways to direct the writer. Show him where to go, how to act, what destination to pursue. And that's why bright spots are so essential, because they are your best hope for directing the writer when you're trying to bring about change. 3. School stinks, said Bobby, a ninth grader who just reported for his first school counseling session. John J. Murphy, the school psychologist, was surprised Bobby had shown up at all. Several teachers had referred Bobby for counseling, frustrated by his bad behavior. He was constantly late, rarely did his homework, was disruptive in class, and sometimes made loud threats to other kids in the hallways. Bobby's home life was just as chaotic. He'd been shuffled in and out of foster homes and special facilities for kids with behavioral problems. He and his father were on the waiting list for family counseling. The local social service agency in Covington, Kentucky, was keeping tabs on Bobby. By the time he showed up for his session with Murphy, he was in danger of being placed in another special facility because of his problems at school. Murphy was almost powerless in the situation. The counselor had no way to improve Bobby's situation at home, and time was working against him. At best, he'd see Bobby for an hour here, an hour there. Murphy couldn't reward Bobby if he behaved well, or punish him if he behaved poorly. Not that punishment would have worked. Bobby usually ended up in the principal's office by mid-morning for disciplinary issues, but his behavior never changed. Ignoring the school stinks comment, Murphy began talking to Bobby and posed a series of unusual questions. So began the first of a handful of conversations between Murphy and Bobby. Now, fast forward to 3 months later. A dramatic change had occurred. The number of days Bobby was sent to the principal's office had declined by 80%. Bobby hadn't become an Eagle Scout, mind you, but the improvement was strong enough to keep social services from having to transfer him to the school for troubled kids. Bobby, a chronic offender, had become an occasional offender, and it happened because of a few hours of talking with a counselor. What exactly happened in those conversations? 4. John Murphy is a practitioner of solutions-focused brief therapy, solutions-focused therapy for short. Solutions-focused therapy was invented in the late 1970s by a husband and wife therapist team, Stephen De Shazar and Insoo Kim Berg, and their colleagues at the Brief Family Therapy Center in Milwaukee. Solutions-focused therapy is radically different from traditional therapy. In classical psychotherapy, think Tony Soprano and Dr. Melfi, you and your therapist explore your problem. What are its roots? Does it trace back to something in your childhood? There's a sense of archaeological excavation. You're digging around your mind for a buried nugget of insight, something that may explain why you behave the way you do. Excavating the past takes time. A standard Freudian psychoanalysis might take 5 years of work, with sessions once or twice a week. And after 5 years and $50,000, you'll discover it's all your mom's fault. Solutions-focused therapists, in contrast, couldn't care less about archaeology. They don't dig around for clues about why you act the way you do. They don't care about your childhood. All they care about is the solution to the problem at hand. Marriage therapist Michelle Wiener Davis was initially trained as a classical psychoanalyst. Like all psychoanalysts, she believed that childhood experiences created unresolved traumas that fed current problems, and she tried to help her clients understand how their upbringing had shaped their behavior and relationships. But she was often unhappy with the outcomes her clients achieved through psychoanalysis. In her book, Divorce Busting, She explained why my clients would frequently plead, "Now I see that we are reenacting our parents' marriages, but what do we do about it? We can't stop fighting." She learned that understanding a problem doesn't necessarily solve it, that knowing is not enough. Wiener Davis was initially skeptical about solutions-focused brief therapy. It seemed too simple. Most people, including most therapists, believe the change process has to be complicated and arduous. No pain, no gain is the general rule of thumb. To describe how her thinking about solutions-focused therapy changed, she used an analogy from golf. At one point, her golf swing started misfiring, so she went to a golf pro, thinking her technique needed a major overhaul. She noted that the golf pro didn't do any archaeology. He never said, "You obviously have a fear of winning. Did your father intimidate you as a little girl?" Instead, all he did was suggest a minor modification, relaxing her tight grip on the club. First, she was a little peeved by this advice. It didn't seem profound enough to justify his fee. But later on the course, her balls were going straighter and farther. "Maybe small adjustments can work after all," she thought. 5. Solutions-focused therapists use a common set of techniques for discovering potential solutions. Early in the first session, after hearing the patient explain his or her problem, the therapist poses the miracle question, "Can I ask you sort of a strange question? Suppose you go to bed tonight and sleep well. Sometime in the middle of the night, while you are sleeping, a miracle happens, and all the troubles that brought you here were resolved. When you wake up in the morning, what's the first small sign you'd like to see that would make you think, 'Well, something must have happened. The problem is gone'?" Here's how one couple in marital therapy answered the miracle question posed by their therapist, Brian Cade of Sydney, Australia. Wife: "I'd be happy feeling at ease at last. I'd be more pleasant to Bob, not jumping down his throat all the time." Cade: "What will you do instead?" Wife: "Well, there would be more understanding between us. We'd listen to what each other was saying." Husband: "Yes, at the moment, we don't really listen to each other. We just can't wait to get our own point in." Cade: "How could you tell that the other was really listening?" Wife: "In the face, I think. We'd perhaps make more eye contact." Then she paused and laughed. "We'd nod in the right places." Husband: "Yes, we'd both respond to what the other was saying rather than just attacking or ignoring it." Notice that Cade prods the couple for specifics. What will you do instead? How could you tell the other person was really listening? The miracle question doesn't ask you how to describe the miracle itself. It asks you to identify the tangible signs that the miracle happened. Here's another example from a therapist's session with a man with a drinking problem. "If a miracle solved your drinking problem, what would you be doing differently the next morning?" "I don't know. I can't imagine." "Try." "Well, all my friends drink, so what do you expect me to do?" "I know it's not easy, but think about it." "Well, there are all sorts of things." "Name one." "Maybe I would go to the library and look at the newspapers." "How would your day be different if you went to the library?" Solutions-focused therapists learn to focus their patients on the first hints of the miracle. What's the first small sign you'd see that would make you think the problem was gone? Because they want to avoid answers that are overly grand and unattainable. "My bank account is full, I love my job, and my marriage is great." Once they've helped patients identify specific and vivid signs of progress, they pivot to a second question, which is perhaps even more important. It's the exception question. When was the last time you saw a little bit of a miracle, even just for a short time? An alcoholic would be asked, "When was the last time you stayed sober for an hour or two?" Or the wife in the dialogue quoted above would be asked, "When was the last time you felt like your husband was truly listening to you?" It's an ingenious tactic. What the therapist is trying to demonstrate in a subtle way is that the client is capable of solving her own problem. As a matter of fact, the client is offering up proof that she's already solved it, at least in some circumstances. For instance, Brian Cade worked with a mother whose children were out of control. He asked the exception question, "What was different about the last time your kids obeyed you? In what circumstances do they seem to behave better?" Mother: After a pause, "I think it's when they realize they have pushed me too far." Cade: "How could they tell that?" Mother: You know, it's funny. I think it's when I stop ranting and raving at them, and my voice goes very, very calm. I think I'm able to do that when I feel generally less harassed, when I feel I've got things done rather than spent the whole day worrying about getting things done. When I feel like I've not been able to get on top of the housework, I tend to panic. Cade asks her what the kids might notice on good days. Mom, I think I just look calmer. Cade, what else? Mom, I probably greet them more enthusiastically and smile more. Solutions-focused therapists believe that there are exceptions to every problem and that those exceptions, once identified, can be carefully analyzed, like the game film of a sporting event. Let's replay that scene where things were working for you. What was happening? How did you behave? Were you smiling? Did you make eye contact? And that analysis can point directly toward a solution that is, by definition, workable. After all, it worked before. These exceptions are just like Jerry Sternin's bright spots. Just as there were some kids in the Vietnamese village who managed to stay healthy despite the poverty, there are some moments in an alcoholic's life when he is sober despite the cravings. Those bright spots are gold to be mined. Notice again that bright spots provide not only direction for the rider, but hope and motivation for the elephant. What does this mean for you? You may not fight malnutrition, and you may not need therapy. But if you are trying to change things, there are going to be bright spots in your field of view, and if you learn to recognize them and understand them, you will solve one of the fundamental mysteries of change. What exactly needs to be done differently? Suppose you're a human relations manager, and you've been encouraging line managers to give feedback to their employees more frequently, rather than storing it up for their once-a-year performance reviews. You hosted an off-site training program for 10 managers so they could practice the recommended new style of in-the-moment feedback, and they all left the program pledging to experiment with it. After 4 weeks, you start to hear back from some of the managers, and the results have been mixed. Two of the managers seem genuinely transformed, excited about the way faster feedback has improved their relationships with team members. Five of the managers are weakly positive, saying they tried it a few times. Two of the managers say, regretfully, that they're too busy to try. One is an outright skeptic and thinks the whole initiative is hogwash. What now? The bright spots give you an action plan. Go investigate the two successful managers. First, see if either situation is an anomaly. For instance, in your follow-up, you might discover that one of the successful managers had not been giving any more feedback to his team. He'd simply been approaching individuals more often to make small talk. The extra social contact made him feel good, but annoyed team members who were constantly interrupted. That manager is not a real bright spot. The other success might be legitimate. Maybe the manager, Debbie, devised a tracking sheet that reminds her to provide feedback to every employee every week. Maybe she had set a goal for herself that her quick feedback will never last longer than 2 minutes and will apply only to a specific project. It won't be a referendum on an employee's overall performance. Maybe she set up an open-door office hours so that employees can drop by for quick feedback on ongoing projects. Now that you've defined your bright spot, you can try to clone it. Have the other managers spend an hour or two shadowing Debbie, seeing firsthand how she incorporated the new style into her workday. Get Debbie to attend your next off-site training program so she can coach other managers on the mechanics of quick feedback. Talk to IT and see if there's a way to roll out a more polished version of Debbie's impromptu tracking sheet. Bottom line, you are spending 80% of your time exploring Debbie's success and finding ways to replicate it. You aren't obsessing about the manager who was skeptical. You aren't planning another training program with the same managers to review the material. You are simply asking yourself, what's working, and how can we do more of it? That's the bright spot philosophy in a single question. 6. Focusing on bright spots can be counterintuitive for businesses. Richard Pascal, one of Jerry Sternin's collaborators, discovered this in 2003 when he accepted a consulting assignment with Genentech. The company had recently launched a drug called Xolair, which had been regarded as a miracle drug for asthma. It had proved effective in preventing asthma attacks for many patients. Yet, 6 months after launch, sales of Xolair remained well below expectations. Pascal and his team were asked to help figure out why Xolair was underperforming. They immediately started looking for bright spots and soon found one. Two saleswomen who worked the Dallas-Fort Worth area were selling 20 times more Zoloft than their peers. Further investigation revealed that the women were using a fundamentally different kind of sales pitch. Rather than selling the health benefits of the drug, which doctors largely understood, they were helping doctors understand how to administer the drug. Zoloft was not a pill or an inhaler. It required infusion via an intravenous drip. This technique was unfamiliar and therefore elephant spooking to the allergists and pediatricians who would be prescribing the drug. Here was a classic bright spot situation. Like the Vietnamese mothers who mixed sweet potato greens into their kids' rice, these saleswomen were achieving radically different results with the same set of resources everyone else had. Having discovered the bright spot, Genentech's managers could help spread the innovation across their entire sales force. But that didn't happen. And here is where a cautionary tale intrudes on our success story. What actually happened was this. The superior results of the Dallas-Fort Worth reps were reviewed with suspicion. Managers speculated that the saleswomen had an unfair advantage, and their initial assumption was that the pair's sales territories, or quotas, needed to be revisited. Later investigation established that the two women had the same type of client base as the other reps. To be fair to the Genentech managers, let's acknowledge that there was indeed a chance that these two reps were simply an anomaly. But the manager's first reaction to the good news was that it must be bad news. That reaction is a good reminder that the writer's capacity for analysis is endless. Even successes can look like problems to an overactive writer. 7. Let's circle back to Bobby, the troubled student, because now we can start to understand his rather abrupt transformation. Here's a brief exchange from one of Bobby's counseling sessions. Notice how Murphy, the school counselor, starts by popping the exception question. Murphy, tell me about the times at school when you didn't get in trouble as much. Bobby, I never get in trouble, well, not a lot, in Ms. Smith's class. Murphy, what's different about Ms. Smith's class? Bobby, I don't know, she's nicer. We get along great. Murphy, what exactly does she do that's nicer? Murphy wasn't content with Bobby's vague conclusion that Ms. Smith is nicer. He kept probing until Bobby identified several things about Ms. Smith and her class that seemed to help him behave well. For instance, Ms. Smith always greeted him as soon as he walked into class. Other teachers understandably avoided him. She gave him easier work, which she knew he could complete. Bobby has a learning disability, and whenever the class started working on an assignment, she checked with Bobby to make sure he understood the instructions. Ms. Smith's class was a bright spot, and as we've seen, any time you have a bright spot, your mission is to clone it. Using Ms. Smith's class as a model, Murphy gave Bobby's other teachers very practical tips about how to deal with him. Greet Bobby at the door. Make sure he's assigned work he can do. Check to make sure he understands the instructions. What Murphy had avoided, of course, was archaeology. He didn't dig into Bobby's troubled childhood, and he didn't try to excavate the sources of his anger and willfulness. For Murphy, all that information would have been TBU, as Sternin would say. True, but useless. The other thing Murphy avoided was Genentech's knee-jerk skepticism. The mental quibbles could have come so easily. Ms. Smith is just a nicer person than the other teachers. Or, her class is easier. Or, teachers shouldn't have to adapt their approach to a problem student. Instead, Murphy found the bright spot and he trusted it. Bobby's teachers were pleased when Murphy approached them with such specific guidance, and they promised to give his recommendations a try. Murphy asked the teachers to help him track whether the solutions were working by recording Bobby's performance on three metrics. 1. Arriving to class on time. 2. Completing assignments in class. And 3. Behaving acceptably in class. Over the next 3 months, as reported earlier, Bobby's rate of being sent to the principal's office for a major infraction decreased by 80%. Bobby also made striking progress on day-to-day behavior as measured by the three metrics. Before solutions-focused therapy, his teachers typically rated his performance as acceptable in only 1 or 2 out of 6 class periods per day. After solutions-focused therapy, he was rated as acceptable in 4 or 5 of the 6 periods. Bobby is still not a model student, but he's a lot better. 8. Notice something remarkable about both the Vietnam and the Bobby case studies. In each one, relatively small changes, cooking with sweet potato greens, greeting Bobby at the door, had a big impact on a big problem. There is a clear asymmetry between the scale of the problem and the scale of the solution. Big problem, small solution. This is a theme you will see again and again. Big problems are rarely solved with commensurately big solutions. Instead, they are most often solved by a sequence of small solutions, sometimes over weeks, sometimes over decades, and this asymmetry is why the writer's predilection for analysis can backfire so easily. When the writer analyzes a problem, he seeks a solution that befits the scale of it. If the writer spots a hole, he wants to fill it. And if he's got a round hole with a 24-inch diameter, he's going to go looking for a 24-inch peg. But that mental model is wrong. For instance, in analyzing malnutrition in Vietnam, the experts had exhaustively analyzed all the big systemic forces that were responsible for it. Lack of sanitation, poverty, ignorance, lack of water. No doubt, they also concocted big systemic plans to address those forces. But that was fantasy. No one, other than Sternin, thought to ask, what's working right now? In reviewing Bobby's situation at high school, the teachers and administrators whispered about all the things that were broken. Broken home, learning disability, uncontrollable impulses. Any normal person analyzing Bobby's situation would have craved an intensive, complex solution to match the intensive, complex problem. But no one, other than the counselor Murphy, thought to ask, what's working right now? To pursue bright spots is to ask the question, what's working? And how can we do more of it? Sounds simple, doesn't it? Yet in the real world, this obvious question is almost never asked. Instead, the question we ask is more problem-focused. What's broken, and how do we fix it?